And it's a psalm of David, and there are only 9 verses, so we'll read them all through together. 20th psalm, beginning to read at verse 1. The Lord hear thee in the day of trouble, the name of the God of Jacob defend thee. Send thee help from the sanctuary and strengthen thee out of Zion. Remember all thy offerings and accept thy burnt sacrifice, Selah. Grant thee according to thine own heart and fulfill all thy counsel. We will rejoice in thy salvation, and in the name of our God we will set up our banners. The Lord fulfill all thy petitions. Now know I that the Lord saveth his anointed. He will hear him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. They are brought down and fallen, but we are risen and stand upright. Save, Lord. Let the King hear us when we call. Amen. And we know the Lord will add his blessing to that reading of his word. Psalms 20 and 21 go together. In Psalm 20, the psalm lets us into the mind of those who are facing battle. And Psalm 21 invites us to the victory parade. Psalm 20, if you like, is a prayer for the battle, and Psalm 21 is praise. 20, it anticipates the battle. 21 reflects on the victory. It's primarily a psalm that's been recorded by David to show the before and after, that he went through a process facing the battle, and then, of course, in 21 we have the praise that follows that. Now, when we think of victory, we should remind ourselves that there are different kinds of battle. Certainly in the life of David, and I think we can apply that to ourselves as well. There are different kinds of battle. The different kinds of battle that David would have known are mainly two. One being what I will call campaigns. And that's where David is the invader, and he's taking the land for the Lord. He's going in and taking the land, a bit like what Joshua did in the land of Canaan. But then the other kind of battle that David would have had to face was what I call a counterattack, when someone else, some other invading king or nation, came against him, and he had to then counterattack. With a campaign, of course, there would be months of planning, strategies would be developed, the time would be set that would be most advantageous, soldiers would be recruited and trained, and then the day would arrive for the advance, and that's a campaign. But with a counterattack, it's different. He perhaps wouldn't have been given a great deal of notice. Perhaps he would have been sent a message that you're to go into the plain of such and such, and we will meet you there, and we will sort this out man to man. And in that case, David's success would really depend on how strong his defences and his preparation already were, and how alert he was, perhaps, when an attack would come in not such a gentlemanly manner, and there would just be an attack made with no warning. But one thing we can certainly take out of the life of David is this. We can expect battles. Battles will come. No sooner will one be over until we will be waiting, or one will be waiting for us round the corner. We'll be engaged in another. And just like David's battles, battles in our lives fall into different categories as well, because as the people of God, whether personally or as a church fellowship, we should have campaigns. There should be times whenever we go out and we seek to go into this world, which is, of course, the domain of the devil, and we do that in the name of the Lord, empowered by him, with all the weapons he has given us, with the real desire and thought that he would be glorified through the salvation of souls. And that's why many outreaches in the past were called gospel campaigns or gospel missions. A mission is a military term, going on a military mission. But then, of course, in our lives too, there are also counterattacks. There are times when the enemy comes in. There are times when he assaults us and we are persecuted and oppressed. And our success then really depends on how strong we have been before that happened. What has been our standing as a Christian whenever the attacks came. So we can expect battles, but we needn't just expect one of each type or whatever, or we can always be on the campaign and only get the odd attack. No, no. If we know anything about the life of David and what his life teaches us and what we can learn from it, it'll be this: we can expect many battles. There's a phrase in 1 Samuel 19 and 8, and it's this, and I think it kind of gets across to us that sighing moment as you read these words. And there was war again. That says it all, doesn't it? And there was war again. Have you ever had a not again moment? You know, when things are kind of going well, and then, and you just go, not again. On that occasion, 1 Samuel 19, it was the Philistines who were to feature greatly and strongly throughout David's reign. But then there was a campaign, 1 Samuel 27. David invades a land populated by the Geshurites, Gezerites, and Malachites. And he invades then another occasion, the city of Jebus, 1 Chronicles 11. And when he takes that city, he renames it Jerusalem. So there were certainly campaigns. But then 2 Samuel 5, and it's the Philistines once more. And then 2 Samuel 8, the Philistines join in league with the Moabites, Syrians and Edomites, and they come at them again. In fact, in 2 Samuel 21, actually, we read of 4 more times the Philistines in quick succession come against David. So not only can we expect many battles, but we can see woven in through that we have enemies who don't give up easily. In fact, we can be attacked from one source once and think that's that, dusted, move on, and be attacked the very same way again. So with that in mind, let's look a wee bit more in a more detailed way at Psalm 20 and see what we can learn from it. Because remember, they are about to go into battle. So this is in that side of the battle. And one of the first things I'm sure you noticed as we read through the psalm was that it appears to be written in such a way that it's a group of people who are talking as much to the king, talking as much to David as they are to the Lord. May the Lord hear you. That's like something we would say in front of the person. And then when we get to verse 6, there's also a revelation, a moment, which suggests a point that is reached when something becomes known in a more full way. And that is, now know I that the Lord saveth his anointed. So whether that's David reaching that conclusion or the people reaching that conclusion having prayed, it's hard to say. But a moment is reached when that is the thought. Now know I that the Lord saves. Now, because of these peculiarities, it has led to a number of ideas being put forward. Albert Barnes writes this: it is composed of alternate parts as if to be used by the people and by the king and by his followers in alternate responses, closing with a chorus to be used by all. And then another division has the first 4 verses, the people expressing their desire for the king. Verse 5, the people expressing their trust in God. Verse 6, the king's response. And then the people's declaration. And they've divided the psalm up in all of these ways. And the attempts to unravel the psalm keep going on and on. But one thing we can say is this. This is a psalm that's full of confidence. Now, it's written before the battle. It's facing the battle, but it's a psalm full of confidence in two ways. They have confidence in their leader, but also they have confidence as in him as the king under God. And they've also confidence in the God who leads their leader. And it's completely interlaced and linked. Confidence in their leader as a leader under God, and also confidence in the God being the God of their leader. And that's an appropriate way for us today at this particular time in, if you like, our church calendar. Whenever we are thinking of getting all the ministries in the church back up and running, that we can think of the winter work ahead of us as a campaign. That we are all in together. Let's remind ourselves of that. This is not just, oh, well, there's that ministry, and there's that ministry, and there's the other ministry. We are all in this campaign together. There may be different departments, that's necessary. We have to have nuances. We have to finely tune things. Things have to be done slightly differently for different groups and so on. But in each department, there's a leader or a team of leaders. Not everybody can be in leadership. Not everybody would want to be in leadership. But what every leader knows is this. They will have battles to face. The devil's not happy when we are on a campaign. Isn't that right? And we will have battles to face. And the enemies that we have around us don't make things easy and don't give up easily. I trust as a church fellowship we will find the encouragements from Psalm 20 to be a blessing for us as we enter the winter work. And the first thing that stands out to me in this psalm is this. There is unity. There's unity. This is a powerful testimony to a union of heart between David and the people, and all of their hearts being united in the Lord and in the Lord's cause. What better way to approach God than to be united? Whether it's a campaign, as we are thinking of in a church setting, or whether it's responding to counterattacks, isn't it good to be united? We have an enemy who would love to sow discord, and he does so for that very reason, that he knows that he has you half beat if we're not united. Psalm 133 in verse 1 and also the end of verse 3 says, "Behold, how good and pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. For there the Lord commanded the blessing, even life forevermore." We see unity. There's a common goal. There's a cause to be backed, to be enthusiastic about. There's an enemy to be conquered. And that can be best done through unity. David is very careful in this psalm to emphasize the we. We will rejoice in thy salvation. That's the people around him who are praying for him. And they're going to rejoice together with him. Isn't that the ideal? They are people who will genuinely rejoice when good things happen in the life of the leader. And obviously good things are going to be happening in the life of the people of God. They're genuinely glad when the leaders are protected, preserved, and blessed, and given the victory. You know, one of the saddest things in church life is whenever I've come across folk professing believers, and they actually revel in the mistakes of others and the misfortunes of of others. They can't wait to get it out there. Get it told. Publishing someone else's downfall, especially someone with whom they have a disagreement. And they will never mention any successes that that individual or their department or anything might have. Only their failures and perhaps even the chastisement of the Lord that comes upon their failures. It's not something to rejoice in, is it? David wants to record here in this psalm the love and grace shown to him by the people that he's trying to lead for God's glory. They're praying for him. They're upholding him. And they rejoice then when they see God come in and answer their prayers on behalf of these leaders. Unity. You know that pianos can go out of tune, don't you? And you may have seen a piano tuner at work. And he has a tuning instrument that is the perfect pitch, and then he tunes the piano to that pitch. If 100 pianos in 100 different towns are all tuned to the same pitch, do you know what happens automatically? They are also automatically in tune with each other. If we are in tune with God, do you know what will happen? We will automatically be in tune with each other. Do you believe that? And this is where the discord comes. The devil has no right amongst us, you know. We're blood washed. We're covered in the blood. We're under his name. We bear his name. How does he get in? Chinks in the armor, isn't that right? So we find that there is unity, but also in the psalm there's the idea of acceptance. Verse 3. Remember all thy offerings and accept thy burnt sacrifices. Now, the people there are not saying to the Lord about David that we want you, Lord, to go back from the very first time David ever offered you an offering and to count them all up. And I'm sure you'll discover, Lord, that he has been a great man at offering. He has outdone everybody else as far as offerings are concerned. And go over all them. Remember all them, Lord. No, that's not what's being said here. There's an offering being made at this time. And there's more than one. So that's why we have the plural all. Sacrifice is being made. There's an offering and a burnt sacrifice. And many people in serving the Lord, we can truly say, make sacrifices. We mightn't ever know the extent of the sacrifices that people make for the gospel. But we know this for sure, that there are many, many people who make sacrifices. But we have to also be careful in this, because it's not sacrifice in and of itself that brings acceptance with God. We know that through sacrifices that were made that weren't accepted by God. Sacrifices that were an abomination to God because God has said do this and the opposite was done. But they still came and made a sacrifice. Making religious offerings was something that kings would do before going into battle. And even in secular history, we have records of heathen kings, including the Caesars, who went to the temple of their choice and offered sacrifices. Bulls and different animals would be slain and so on before they went into battle. But in verse 3, there are two types of offering mentioned. The meal offering is really the first one that's being mentioned there. And then the burnt offering. The meal offering, the bloodless offering, was designed to give someone an opportunity to come into the tabernacle or temple with that offering and gain the favor of the Lord. They could come and do that to give thanks to the Lord for something that the Lord has done. Or just to worship the Lord. But the other one, the burnt offering, that was designed to deal with something that perhaps would mar the blessing, something that would prevent God's favor, deals with sin. But we should never forget that in this Old Testament order of bringing sacrifices, in order for them to be effectual, they had to be offered in faith. It didn't matter how right they were regarding the Levitical law, that it was the right animal and it had been examined properly and it had been brought in the right way and the priest had dismantled it the right way. That was secondary. What was important was that all of those offerings were offered in faith. And there's the great connection between us and our understanding of salvation through Jesus Christ and his death on the cross and the Old Testament. It is by faith. Now, when you think about Hebrews 11 and you think about many of the things that people went through, which were definitely sacrificial, they stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. And a whole list of things goes down, and it ends up with, of whom the world was not worthy. But how does that statement begin in Hebrews 11? Who through faith? John 5:4, for whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world. This is the victory that overcometh the world. What is it? Even our faith. It wasn't just a case of having the biggest and best offering that could be bought and afforded. It had to be done with two things, faith and obedience. Saul was one of those I was referring to earlier. God had said something very clearly before he fought the Amalekites. But Saul thought he knew better. And he thought, well, you know what? I'm going to take all of this livestock and it's going to be used. Sure, we can offer it to God. And those great words, famous words, come through. To obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of lambs. Acceptance this morning. Remember how Jesus commended the scribe in Mark chapter 12. The scribe said to him, Master, thou hast said the truth well. There is one God and there is none other but he. And to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding, with all the soul and with all the strength, and to love his neighbor as himself, is more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. That's what the scribe said. And Jesus said, thou art not far from the kingdom. They've got it. 1 John 3:22, whatsoever we ask, we receive of him because, now here's a because. Because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. We have to be cautious, haven't we, when we come with our sacrifices. Jesus said in Matthew 5, if you bring your gift to the altar and remember that your brother has something against you, leave there your gift, go be reconciled, and then come and offer your gift. So there's a great emphasis on faith and on acceptance of the offering. The heart has to be right. And that's the bottom line. And if that is so, then we can see what is meant then in verse 4. So we've just had acceptance in verse 3. Verse 4, may the Lord grant you according to your heart, or grant you your heart's desire, and fulfill all your counsel. And the end of verse 5, and fulfill all your petitions. So a case has been building here. Unity. There's acceptance. And if God is finding your service and the move you're about to make acceptable and pleasing to him, may the Lord grant you your heart's desire. This is not just willy-nilly heart's desire. We could all pray that, couldn't we? Lord, grant you your heart's desire. Who knows what's in your heart? But this is measured. This is appropriate. heart's desire that's mentioned here. If your sacrifice is acceptable, may the Lord grant you your heart's desire. There's something else, unity, acceptance. But there's also realization. And the people who are petitioning the Lord on behalf of their king have made an important realization, and we need to do that and keep that before our minds. And that is, we need to realize the strength of the enemy. There's a list of items in Ephesians chapter 6 which form what we call the armor of God. But at the end of that list, we read this, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints. As many words as Paul can employ to say, pray, 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 and pray. What a weapon! And what's the reason? Well, still in Ephesians 6. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Romans 8. Angels, principalities, powers, things present, things to come. 1 Corinthians 15. Rule, authority, and power. Colossians 2. Principalities. Peter then says in 1 Peter 5 and 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil goeth about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Never forget, the enemy's strong. The enemy's strong. And also never forget, leaders are weak. And we see that in our psalm. Verse 2, send thee help from the sanctuary and strengthen thee. Verse 6, saving strength at the end of the verse. And in verse 7, although we don't have the word, strength is implied. Some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. Help. That's what all the folk and all the ministries in our fellowship are saying to the membership today. Help. Help. That's what I'm saying to you today. Help. What kind of help? Reinforcements? Bigger budgets? More helpers? You know, divine victory doesn't depend on human ability or numbers. Some trust in chariots, some in horses. But, there's another of those buts. But we will remember the name of the Lord our God. This is the David who went out against Goliath alone. That's a good start for a career, wasn't it? Think of Elijah, went against those hundreds of idolatrous prophets alone. Think of Gideon, and here's what he had to face. The Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along the valley like grasshoppers for multitude. Who did he go out with? 300 men. We have such a powerful and amazing God that one with him's a majority. People in this psalm had grasped something. And they pray, send help from the sanctuary, strengthen thee out of Zion. These are places that are connected with God's name. And they're also connected with God's presence. God said, I will dwell among you. But as well as that, they are symbolic of what we read then in verse 6. Now I know that the Lord saveth his anointed. He will hear from his holy heaven, because Zion, Jerusalem, and the temple, / tabernacle, they were all just things that pictured something else. Pictured something not made with hands. Where God is. We have a God who's in heaven today. We have a God who's still on the throne today. We're not looking for help from other people as weak as ourselves. We are appealing to help from the God of heaven. And it's He who gives us the strength we need. Do you need strength today? Mightn't be a campaign that you're involved in. It might be an attack that you're facing. And attacks come in all shapes and forms. And you just go, like I said at the start, not again. And you just feel your strength leave you. Do you need strength? Well, there's something else in this psalm, and it's confidence. It's not confidence in David, and it's not David's confidence in his people, although they're praying people. It's confidence in this repeated phrase, the name. Verse 1, the name of the God of Jacob defend thee. Verse 5, in the name of our God will we set up our banners. Verse 7, we will remember the name of the Lord our God. The power of his name. We have spent many weeks thinking of the combined names of Jehovah or Yahweh. Jehovah Hosseinu, the Lord our Maker. Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of Hosts. Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. Jehovah Ezer, the Lord our Help. Jehovah Makadishkim, the Lord our Sanctifier. Jehovah Rophi, the Lord our Healer. Jehovah Rohi, the Lord our Shepherd. Jehovah Shalom, the Lord our Peace. Jehovah Tsidkenu, the Lord our Righteousness. And many others. But one of those names is Jehovah Nissi, the Lord our Banner. And we have that in verse 5 there. We will set up our banners in the name of the Lord. Banners had a purpose. So they spoke of allegiance. You come from Northern Ireland, you would know exactly what I mean by that. They also stir courage. They can give signals. They can also muster. And they can even intimidate the enemy. I love these words in Isaiah 59:19. So if we are facing attack today or will face attack, remember this verse. Write it down. Quote it. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard against him. Isn't that a powerful verse? Do we realize the power of that? And then there's Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts, all hosts, heavenly hosts, all those principalities and powers. Watch out. Why? We have the Lord of all hosts, who spoils principalities and powers, has spoiled them. And then behind the scenes, you have the name of Jehovah Shalom, who in the middle of your attacks, in the middle of your difficulties, in the middle of trying to go on the campaign for God, in the middle of it, oh, Jehovah Shalom, my peace. The Lord is our peace. Isaiah 5 and 26. He will lift up an ensign to the nations. And the nations from far will hiss unto them from the end of the earth. And behold, they shall come swiftly. You know, God has an amazing plan for this old world. And all he has to do is lift up the banner. And things will start to happen. He could be lifting up the banner while we speak prophetically. Isn't that amazing? Jehovah Ezer, the Lord, our help. Isaiah 11. The standard that Isaiah's prophecy has been mentioning gives given a personality. I love this. Isaiah 11, verses 10 and 12. In that day, there shall be a root of Jesse, that was David's father, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, and to it shall the Gentiles seek. Does that remind you of anyone? And his rest shall be glorious. You know, we're gathered here today under a banner, and it's printed with one word, Jesus. We're gathered in his name. Psalm 16 verse 4, thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee. Picture David as he and is preparing. And there he is, and he has all these thoughts in his mind, all this responsibility. He's anxious, probably fearful. And he listens to his people pray for him. I want you to get that. May the Lord hear you. May the Lord send you help. May the Lord remember all your sacrifice. May the Lord give you the desires of your heart. May the Lord fulfill all your petitions. He hears the people pray for him. I'm sure there are some here and you're brought up in a Christian home. And one of your abiding memories is probably like mine, listening to a mother or father pray audibly at their bedside for us. What a privilege. Is it any wonder we have these words, and I think they are the words of David in verse 6. People are with him, united. He has come with the right heart and right attitude. His sacrifices are purely for the honor and glory of God. He knows the folk will rejoice if victory comes, and he's able to say this, I now know. This has bolstered my confidence. This has given me the lift I need. The Lord's going to see it. You know the climax of the people's praying, because it's back to them by verse 9. It's really those two words at the start of the verse. Save, Lord. Aren't those two words we should be crying out to God with? For no matter who's involved in what, we are all in it together. Remember that. But here's the thing we want over and above every other detail and I that must be dotted and T that must be crossed is the cry of your heart. Lord, we want to be seen as this or seen as that. Or as the cry of your heart, save, Lord. Let that be our campaign cry today. Will you pray that prayer?